Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Mika Simmons, and you're listening to the Happy Vagina Podcast. Coming up, we have Nell Hudson. Author and star of Outlander and Victoria, and we do a deep dive into her reclamation of objectification and why laughter is the very best medicine. But first, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our sponsors. As you know, this is an independent podcast. I like to keep it that way, so I can choose controversial topics and interview guests for their insights, not their star meter. And this week's episode is sponsored by Beija London. Beija is a London-based lingerie and swimwear brand for all body shapes, with cup sizes from AA up to 36H. I've been wearing Beija for the last few months, and the perfect fit and support of the bra with just a hint of lift, simply designed with just a touch of sass, makes them perfect for day to night, under a t-shirt or for a hot date with yourself. If you're unsure of your size, they also offer a 20-minute online bra fitting to make sure you get the right shape and size to ensure you feel you're most content and empowered. Just go to www.beija.london. That's B-E-I-J-A. www.beija.london. And once you've chosen your bra, pull some knickers to match. Then use our code THEHAPPYVAGINA at checkout to receive 15% off your first order. That's The Happy Vagina at www.beija.london. Welcome to the Happy Vagina Podcast, dedicated to celebrating pioneers in the female space who've made a difference in women's health, equality and relationships. Each week, we chat to an inspiring human being as they explore the experiences that completely change their outlook, promising not only to educate, but also to entertain and enlighten. And today, the Happy Vagina has gone into the wild, and we are live from Jupiter Rising Arts and Music Festival in Scotland at Jupiter Artland. Jupiter Rising, hello. It's so good to be here. This is the Happy Vagina's first festival. We've done a lot of lives, but this is an honour to be at this festival. And I am joined today by the multi-talented author, yoga teacher, star of Outlander and Victoria and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I've not been able to watch yet because I'm too terrified, actress Nell Hudson. Nell, welcome to the Happy Vagina.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honour and a pleasure.
This is a long time coming. I've been promising Nell to interview her for the last 2 years, and I think she thought that I was lying, but I was saving a very special occasion like this to interview her. And this is a special occasion because the theme is the source, and that means, for those of you that can't see, we are sat on stage in front of a giant pink vulva, aren't we now?
It's beautiful.
Can you describe it?
It's like a milfoy of pink layers with beautiful black sprouting pubic hairs all around it. It's quite warm in here, and I feel like I'm being reborn.
There is a rebirth going on, so it's quite squidgy, and I think probably if anyone gets really drunk, they could probably just have a little bit of a snooze on there later. I do know people that sometimes sort of sleep against the wall at nightclubs. Actually, it's my brother. He'll quite often find a wall, lean against it. So if anyone at the festival later wants someone to go and lean against and have a bit of a snooze, I recommend the vulva here. It's very squidgy. Anyway, we are absolutely honoured to be here, and we are going to get the source juices flowing immediately with the Happy Vagina quiz. Now, I know that you're a fan of the pod and you know all about this quiz, so we're just going to dive straight in.
Fab.
We've got five questions for you. They are either or. This is a very binary quiz. It's quite Generation X, but I do tend to find it brings out some very interesting discussions. So, now Hudson, question number one, brief or G-string?
G-string? I'm so embarrassed. I genuinely...
No, but can we just... Let's just...
Let's just pause there before we go any further.
Okay.
Why are you embarrassed that it's a G-string?
I feel like it makes me a bad feminist that I prefer wearing G-strings. But I do. I find them more comfortable. I feel held and contained.
Can we just unpick that though? Mm. What is it about wearing a G-string that makes a woman a bad feminist? Because I feel exactly the same way.
Well, there was the famous case in Ireland, wasn't there, when a woman was accusing a man of rape and the defense lawyer held up the woman's black G-string and said, but she was wearing a black G-string. So she was obviously asking for it. So there's definitely a stigma around what wearing a G-string means, and it's as if we're sort of wearing them in order to tempt someone. I remember in the film, I think it's in 10 Things I Hate About You, 90s classic. Mm. Or is it noughties? God, I'm old. Yeah. Anyway.
Great film.
They go through the leading female's underwear drawer and they find a black thong and they're like, that means she wants to get laid. And I saw that film when I was like 9 and it's stuck with me to this podcast.
I know, but what you're talking about essentially is slut shaming and objectification, which is going to be our main topic today. Mm-hmm. Let's not go too deep into it now because I have nothing to talk about later. But objectification, slut, and shaming in general. And it's still, to me, slightly peculiar that what you've just described and the whole concept of what underwear a woman wears might make us a good or a bad feminist. I mean, I think one of the things that is suggested about a woman who dresses provocatively, because that's the insinuation there. The insinuation is that if you are wearing a slightly ratty piece of underwear, you are a provocative person. And one of the things, the suggestions that comes up over and over again, is that that means that that woman is not that intelligent. So there's the next step of it, is that a woman who is dressing in a way that is in any way sexual is not an intelligent being. So lots to unpick there. We're going to come back to it. Yeah. But also, when I was getting ready to come to this festival, I don't know if you had this, did you? Like, so I was packing loads of thongs and I was like, is there going to be loos? Am I going to need to pee in a field? And if I pee in a field this weekend, is it better to bring a brief? Because then, so you're squatting and you're peeing in the field, and you take your trousers down. And at one stage, I was going to wear a jumpsuit, and I thought, what are you doing? Then you put your breasts out as well. So you take your knickers down, okay? You take your jeans down, and then you take your knickers down to pee in the field. And then if you're wearing a brief, then you're covering your bottom quicker than you would be when you were wearing a thong. Now, did you have any of these kind of thoughts?
No, but I'm like a shameless peer. Like, I'm like, oh, well, there's my bum.
Oh, really?
It's like a well-known, like, friends and family, like, know that I will pee anywhere.
Really?
Yeah, especially if you're wearing a dress or a skirt, you can pee in public.
Okay, but... Okay.
Because you've got a tent around you.
Okay, but
not that I'm advocating breaking the law.
No, I mean, that is what I was going to say, because it is actually illegal to pee in public.
I know, but then build more toilets for women. Men have these bloody standing up urinals all over town, and women don't have anything, so...
I was going to ask you about that.
Reclaim the streets.
Reclaim the streets. Pee in the streets, women. That's the next campaign, peeing the streets. But have you ever used one of those sort of like...
clitoral?
Yeah.
Well, no,
I haven't either. Okay, we'll drop that subject. Let's move on. Next question, Brazilian or bush?
Both.
Yes.
I have such bad body dysmorphia, which I feel like is a relevant topic for this podcast, because it is such, I feel like, a feminine leaning. It's not that men don't have it and non-binary people don't have it. Everyone has it. But I feel better about myself when it's tidy, just in general. And I have that with like having a tan or like my hair looking nice. Just there's certain things that I do for me that probably if I lived on a desert island and I'd never seen a magazine or a supermodel, I wouldn't feel the need to do. Right. But it's a sort of, it's for me, like I feel better.
And is that, because I kind of like come in and out of that. Is that quite consistent for you, that is a necessity for your mental health?
I wouldn't say it's a necessity. And believe me, I get rage. If a man ever said, like, told me what to do with it, I would find it hard not to punch him in the face.
Right, right.
So I'm an advocate of the bush.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's probably a little bit hypocritical of me in a way to not always wear one myself. But, like, I won't have a nervous breakdown if my pubes grow.
I was recently wild swimming and a woman walked out of the wild swimming with a swimsuit and a huge bush. And I was like, come on, things are changing. This is good. Mm. But I also advocate for people to do whatever they want to. Next question. Menstrual cup or tampon?
Tampon. I've never tried a menstrual cup, so I can't say I'm against them. I love a tampon. Mm. Hate sanitary towels. Mm. I feel like I'm wearing a nappy.
Mm. Next question. You're going to really regret giving me a quick answer to that one.
Okay.
Or maybe not. Maybe not. It's a happy vagina quiz. Anything can happen.
Whee.
Clitoral or G-spot?
Both, again, but clitoral, historically. I think only in recent years for me was I like, oh, the G-spot. And it's taken 15 years of having sex. And that's great. I'm so happy for myself. Because it's so lovely.
And has the new... So obviously one of the really significant pieces of science that's come out in the last maybe 10 years is that they're actually kind of the same thing. So it's really important that we keep them separate because they are different areas of pleasure. But the G-spot is actually the back of the nerve endings of the clitoris. So it's the clitoral urethral complex. And that is now kind of being spoken about quite widely in mainstream media and magazines and stuff. Has that... Because it helped me... Yeah. I was like, oh, that's all it is. It's not some elusive thing. And of course, some women have it and some don't because it depends on how your body's made up. Mm. So it's not like you're missing a trick by not having it. You just may not have the anatomy that would be able to support that. Did that help you at all?
Yeah, seeing the diagram where you see like the, is it called the legs of the clitoris that extend like all the way around the back? I was like, oh, that's why it feels good.
Yeah, yeah. Last question on our quiz is normally about a vibrator or a hand, but because we're in Scotland and because I know that you have a soft spot for Scotland, having filmed Outland up here, my last question is Arthur's Seat.
We're wondering what this segue is.
Arthur's Seat or Nelson's Column?
What does that mean? What's that a euphemism for? Okay, Nelson's Column means dildos.
Well, it could do
is
now.
Is that what we're saying?
It could do now. It could.
An Arthur's... What? An Arthur's Seat?
Arthur's Seat. You can take it historically. You can take it architecturally. Okay. You can take it agriculturally or you could take it sexually, whichever you want.
Well, my dad calls me Nelson because my name is Nell. So I feel like I have a weird loyalty to Nelson. Nelson's Column.
Okay.
This feels weird talking about sex and then being like, my dad has a nickname for me.
Well, I mean, considering you've just admitted you recently found the G-spot, I think choosing Nelson's Column is really appropriate.
Thanks.
I am surprised that you didn't choose Arthur's Seat because obviously you do have a very fond... That's the end of the quiz, I should just say, in case anyone thinks I'm going to say anything else outrageous. You do have a very fond relationship with Scotland, don't you?
Yeah, for sure. I love Scotland. I'd been to Scotland a couple of times as a child and been really entranced by it. It felt like a place where all the kind of mythological fairy tales of my childhood could actually happen. And then, I came to film Outlander here back in 2013 was the first year I think I filmed that, which is almost 10 years ago, which is crazy. And so I have quite a close relationship with it. I feel like I lived in Glasgow for the first series of that. So I feel like I know Glasgow pretty well and have got to know Edinburgh better over the years. And I just love it. It's funny, you cross the border and you're just like, you can feel this kind of different atmosphere in the air. It is a different culture and a different feeling.
It's very special, isn't it? I love it up here too, but I am going to have to ask you about the mythical fantasies from when you were a child that you just mentioned.
I just love stories. Obviously, I'm an actor and a writer, so stories is life.
But so when you were a child...
Just to sound pretentious.
I don't think that's pretentious. I just watched this amazing TED talk where a man was just talking about the missing element of how, as children, we're all forced into thinking that math is more important than creativity. And it's just not. Einstein said, imagination is more important than thought. But I'm quite curious what the feeling was for you. Like you, so if that quality of the myth and the fantasy was something that you were inside of or exploring as a child, what was it about Scotland that made you feel like anything was possible here? I kind of know what the feeling is, but what was it for you?
I find place, location very evocative, and that is, I think, funnily enough, we've been talking about ADHD recently, and I think part of potentially having an ADHD brain is that when I find something that I am interested in, I'm like completely consumed by it and obsessed with it, and my imagination runs wild. And I had that a bit with coming to Scotland. It was like, oh, I'm in it. I'm in the story. And that just engulfed me.
I think the light up here is really exceptional as well. I was up here back in May, actually here in Jupiter Artland, and I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and it was still light outside, and I was like, this is a magical place. You know, maybe it's because it's so far up. I don't know, but I remember as a child too feeling like it's a sense of familiarity but also difference. I guess coming to the festival, the Edinburgh Festival, the Fringe Festival, is particularly special because there are so many artists around. But like you, coming to Scotland outside of that really kind of like dense period of time when there's so many artists around. Like last summer, I came up to Scotland on holiday and we went wild swimming. And it's one of those memories that I'm never, ever going to forget. Mm. It just touched my heart and my soul. Moving on now, you are kind of the darling of period dramas. So Victoria and mm-hmm. Outlander, as mm-hmm. I just mentioned, you also have just done Texas Chainsaw Massacre. With Victoria, I'd like to talk about that a bit, because one of the things that I've got really into since starting The Happy Vagina is this thing called the clit test. Do you know about that?
Not really, no.
So the clit test was basically, there's something called the Blechdal test, which is a couple of women feminists described that if you had for a film to pass a Blechdal test, you had to have two women in a scene within the film not talking about a man, essentially. And it was really difficult to make that happen. So a very clever woman who I know started the clit test, which is doing really well. And essentially it is a suggestion that within film, that a woman's pleasure, the clitoris or an orgasm, should be at least mentioned. And I can tell you right now that there's only one period drama, and that's Bridgerton, which to me is not even really a period drama. I'm a little bit like, is this a period drama really? Because it's so modern, right, in its feeling. But that is the only period drama that has passed that test. Mm. And I wanted to talk to you a bit about your experience on Victoria. Is there any sex in Victoria?
There was sex in Victoria. There weren't, you know, intense sex scenes. It was kind of done Gone with the Wind style, where you just sort of show a woman in bed postcoital with her hair looking a little mussed and smiling to herself knowingly.
And was it fairly portrayed between the men and the women?
I remember doing a scene that was me and the character playing my love interest, Ferdinand Kingsley, who played Francatelli in the series, and we were meant to be postcoital, and we were both servants in the show, and it was like we'd had a quickie on our lunch break. And he had to be topless, and I was like in all my full petticoats and clothes. I was completely covered up and he was topless, and I remember him being like, oh, I feel a little bit uncomfortable, because I didn't he wasn't warned, basically, because as a man they assumed he'd be fine with having his top off. But for me, I was like, well, it makes sense. Like, the number of buttons and fastenings on Victorian clothes, like, you would just hoik your skirts up if you were having a quickie like that. And, yeah, if the passion struck the man in the moment and he wanted to take his shirt off, then cool.
I mean, the reason that I just laugh so strongly is because, like, literally from the beginning of time, generally it's the other way around.
Yeah, oh, totally. Normally you have a butt-naked woman and the guys, just unzipping.
Yeah. Would Victoria pass the clit test?
I doubt it. No.
And when you were like prepping for Victoria, did you do any research into sex in that era? Like, do you think it was an accurate representation? So you played one of the women that was working in Victoria's household.
Yes.
But with her, what did you learn from doing the series? Was there any kind of like research that you did that taught you about Victoria's relationship with sex?
Definitely. So we are so lucky in that Victoria wrote diaries religiously. So we have those as a primary source of information to learn about her. And she alludes a lot to her sex life with Albert and says, you know, that she's happiest when in his embrace and he's whispering tender, loving words to her. And they're She says that she's kind of buried in his chest, and she says all these like very sweet, lovely references to their sex life, basically. It's quite clear that they had quite a good time in bed, I think, and she really fancied him.
But how does that kind of like correspond with the idea that within Victorian Britain there was the role of a woman within the partnership relationship of marriage, that the woman wasn't supposed to expect pleasure? Is that right? Did you ever find out how that kind of like tied in, what the politics of the day were around men and women, and what the role of the man and woman was in the bedroom and within the household versus what Victoria was doing? Like, did it, which is the truer version?
I think what is easy to forget when making a period drama is that these are real people, because I think we see period drama characters a lot as just like, you know, aliens almost from the past who didn't have feelings and didn't kind of... Are we allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yes.
They didn't shit and fuck and cry and do you know what I mean? And have anxiety and wonder what the meaning of life was and all that sort of thing and get annoyed with their siblings. Do you know what I mean? And I think probably that the more accurate thing is that people, of course people enjoyed sex. People are people. People have always enjoyed sex. But you were right in that the role of the women of the day was to have sex purely for having children, and it was considered unwomanly and unladylike and sort of lowly if you acted like you liked it. And in fact, there's a guide for wives at the time that instructs women to like coyly turn your cheek if he tries to kiss you, and then pretend you need the loo if he makes an advance. And
what, to get out of having
to get
sex.
Out of having sex, there's like tips of like how to get out of it, even when you're married, even when it's like all consensual and you're married and God's
is
signed
this
off
like
on it.
An actual like pamphlet from the time.
Yeah, it's a book. It's called A Guide for Husbands and Wives. I can't remember the name of the author, but a woman wrote it. And
what?
A woman wrote it. What? Always. Well, it's, I think it's mostly for women to be like, what do I do when I get married?
Wow.
But I mean, great advice. Literally... If you don't want to have sex, ladies, just pretend you need a wee.
I'm still sort of like trying to get my head around what the difference was between the regal status and those with money and power, and then what was going on in kind of what, you know, normal living. Did you get any sort of like conversation about that when you were doing the show? Did Jenna get to have any sex?
No, we both know the answer to that. No. Victoria and Albert had sex scenes, yeah, and other characters had sex scenes too. I think David Oakes's character, who was the Prince Ernest, Albert's brother, had quite a racy sex scene because he visited a brothel in the show, because famously Ernest contracted syphilis and that's why he died young. And I think that was obviously, you know, running rampant at the time. So I guess that was a big difference as well, was, you know, trying to avoid disease.
It's so difficult, isn't it? I mean, there was an amazing exhibition up in Scotland that I missed in 2021 that actually really deeply looked into the history of sex and sexual behaviours, because I think we're gathering so much information. That's why Victoria's diaries are so helpful, because we're kind of gathering information from, you know, it's tricky, isn't it, to get a good sense of history, I guess, around something that is so riddled with shame.
Yeah.
Because that's really the issue with it, is that what's the truth and what's not the truth about sex historically.
We're going to take a very quick ad break. And before we do, I wanted to let you know that this podcast was produced in association with Albright, the leading career network for women. Got a mission, a 5-year plan, or an outrageous dream? Albright will have your back. They had mine. Visit www.albrightcollective.com to join their free community today, or download the Albright app, available in the App Store. Albright, a global sisterhood for ambitious women.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now, I do want to talk a little bit about what happened for you during Victoria, because you've just published a book called Just for Today, and it was while you were filming Victoria that first came to you as an idea. Why? Well, I mean, your mum is an author, obviously. Questa is very successful fictional, so it's not like completely out of the blue. But what was going on during that period in your life while you were shooting Victoria that you started to get the feeling of that you wanted to write a book?
I think I've always written something or other, whether it was just like scribbling really bad poetry or short stories or songs or anything really, scripts. And then I was just traveling so much. Something no one told me about being an actor is that you're constantly on trains or planes or waiting around in a trailer. So I just had a lot of like space, basically. And I always think creativity is an energy, and it's like it needs a release valve and you have to let it out somehow. And it was sort of bubbling up within me. And I had all these train journeys up and forth to Yorkshire to film Victoria. So, and I find train journeys very creative space, that kind of like liminal period. And yeah, the views and just kind of, yeah, you're kind of neither here nor there, literally. And yeah, I just started scribbling something in a notebook, and lo and behold, the notebook just became full. And then that was the beginning of my book.
And did it kind of flow out of you? Was it like you started writing it and then just carried on, or did it kind of flow and then ebb quite a lot? Because that's how my writing
definitely
goes.
Definitely like long periods of deep flow state, and it just pours out of me. When I do it, it pours out of me, but then I have these big breaks, either because I'm working on an acting project, or, you know, just going through a period of intense self-doubt and just wanting to run away from it and bury my head in the sand, or whatever reason. But it's very kind of like feast or famine process for me.
And does the self-doubt, I mean, does it come from specific things that happen in your life, or does it sometimes just come out of nowhere?
That's a really good question. If it comes from something, I haven't identified the trigger. I wish I knew. I think it's just really hard work, like, you know, from writing a book. Writing a book's bloody hard work, and it takes a really long time. And so inevitably, during that whole process, there are going to be moments where you just want to give up, and you're just tired and you've had enough. And I think so the brain's way of excusing that behavior for me maybe is to go like, it's shit anyway, don't bother. And then you kind of have to come back to it after a while and see it with new eyes.
And did you do so? For me, one of the things with writing, so I've just written the Haffertina book, which we've got here today.
Yay!
Yes. And now it's just written just for today. And with me, I'm writing a feature film script now, and one of the constant thoughts I have is, this isn't an interesting subject matter. Like, no one's going to care about this subject matter. Did you have any of that?
I worried about the level of privilege of my characters that I was writing, reflecting my own privilege, and people being like, I can't relate to this because all these people have fairly easy lives. And that worried me a little bit. And would people be able to engage? But I think, as I was saying about period drama characters, to bring it back to that, like, human truth is human truth and feelings are feelings. And I think regardless of sort of social status, those universal human truths are true for everyone. But the self-doubt I had wasn't so much around that. It was more just if I could write or not, you know. It was my first book. No one had told me to write a book. I didn't have a book deal. I didn't have a literary agent. So for all I knew, it was for nothing. It was just gonna be 3 years of my life and 90,000 words just in the bin.
And for those people who are here today and listening later on the podcast, can you just say a little bit about what the story of the book is?
So the story of the book is, it begins and ends with a tragedy. It's a year in the life of the heroine, who is called Joni. And she is 25 going on 26. And it's kind of a year of awakening for her, and loss of innocence, and kind of falling in love with the wrong person, and realizing that the party, as my publishers gave me the great tagline, the party has to end sometime. She's kind of realizing that there are consequences and that you sort of have to grow up at some point.
And is Jolie you?
No. She started out as me for about 3 sentences and then ran away with herself and totally became her own person. But I'm really fond of her. I like really care about her. She feels like a little sister or something.
So when you were first writing Just For Today and Jolie was you, was it always going to be a fiction? Was it going to be a fictionalized version of you? Or was there any stage when you were going to write a memoir?
No, it wasn't. It never started out as a memoir. It was just that I'd had some experiences in my 20s that I was like, these are great stories. I've got to put them in a book. And then, to be honest with you, have you read The Secret History by Donna Tartt?
I have.
I'm obsessed with that book. And I just wanted to write another Secret History because I love that book so much. And I read all her books, and then I read all the books that everyone said were similar to that book, and nothing like scratched the itch in the same way as Secret History had done. And I was like, I'll write one. So in the original version of my book, there was going to be a murder.
Yeah.
And then as I began to write it, it just became a more kind of like human coming of age story.
Yeah. I would say 90% of my female friends, when I ask them what their favourite book is, say
Secret History.
The Secret History of Edwin Tartt. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's not my favourite anymore, but I think it definitely hits you really hard the first time you read it, if you're kind of at that age.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you've had some, there were some stories in your 20s that you thought were a really good piece of content for a book. Which is your favourite story from your own experience in your 20s?
I think The Seal. There's a moment in my book where two characters are swimming in the sea in the middle of the night in Cornwall. And they're in the sea, and this happened to me. I was swimming in the sea with a friend. In the book, it's a love interest, but it happened to me with a friend. And we'd just driven down from London. It took us like 7 hours. So we just jumped straight in the sea naked and we're like, woo, under the stars. And then we heard this noise behind us like this. And we were like, what the fuck is that? And we both like swam out the sea, like clambering over each other, like pushing each other back to the beast, being like, you get eaten, not me. And then we stood on the beach, like holding each other, screaming. And then we looked and it was just like a really cute seal.
But seals are quite dangerous, aren't they?
I don't know, but it seemed very innocent, like a dog. When we saw it, it was like, oh, it's like a puppy, bless. But in the water, that instinct of like, oh my God, it's a monster. It's a monster or a shark or something.
Now, I thought you were going to tell me some debauched story about like some cocaine-fueled night.
Very clean.
Where like, I don't know, like you jumped on the train tracks and the train came and it's about a seal. It's so lovely.
It's very wholesome.
But I do think the seals are actually quite dangerous. Does anybody know in the audience? No, but seriously.
The Happy Vagina, Nikki. AKA the Seal Awareness Podcast. Really important message.
We're gonna put something up at the end of the podcast if you're in danger of being attacked by a seal. One of the things that's been said about your book is that it is a, and you've just referred to, it's a loss of innocence. That time in one's life when you start to realize that you've got responsibilities and that, as you've said, there are consequences to some of your actions. And to me, when I read that and when I read the book, I thought, oh, it's about growing up and actually becoming an adult. Do you feel like the book has helped you become an adult now? Or do you feel like you're an adult before you wrote the book? Or do you think it's changed you as a person?
So many deep questions rolled into one. I definitely thought I was an adult when I wrote it, and now I am so aware of how not much of an adult I remain that I look back and I'm like, you baby, you idiot. Yeah. but that's kind of relevant for her as well, I think. What's really weird is that from 0 to 10, you're a child and you're just starting to have memories, right? You're starting to have a brain that wakes up and starts recording. And then from 10 to 20, you just like wish for the next decade really hard. You're like, oh my God, I'm at school. For me anyway, I'm so bored. I can't wait for the next chapter of my life to begin. I can't wait to get out of school and to live my life. And then 20 to 30 is the first decade of your life where you go, shit, that decade's over. Whoa, that went quickly. When I turned 30, I was like, oh my God, that was it. That was my 20s. Are you joking? Can I do it again, please? And I think that's where I'm at the moment with that. And Joni's not there yet. The protagonist of my novel is in the middle of that, I think.
But also, I lost my mom when I was 27. But when she was here during that period, one of the greatest things that she ever said to me, because I think I just left university and I was maybe at drama school, and my mom just said to me that she always thought the 20s were, of course, that every decade of life has its challenges, but there's something about that period of time in your 20s where you're supposed to be taking care of yourself and becoming a grown-up that is particularly challenging. It's like a cognition, like this whole kind of like about change where you've been through these systems that have mollycoddled you to a certain extent and you're having to grow up.
Yeah.
It is a difficult period. What would you say your greatest gift from writing the book is?
Ooh, my greatest gift from writing the book. It means that I can say when people meet me and think I'm a dumb blonde actress, I have a book out, actually. That's the main thing.
Which is just the perfect segue to that wasn't scripted, by the way. That was just brilliant. Or maybe she's just incredibly clever. Because as I mentioned earlier, one of the suggestions around women... Listen, I think it's really important just to say that I do understand that men and women and all genders have their own struggles with being shamed and issues of how we're perceived and all that. But because I'm talking to Nell, I'm going to keep it about women. But you have expressed, you know, both publicly and to me privately now, that you get very angry and confused around the objectification of women. And as I referenced earlier, women who dress provocatively are often thought of as stupid. And you've just said that one of the reasons you like the fact that you've got the book is so that you can prove to people that you're intelligent. And I have to tell you, Nell, we have a book club together. Mm. And when Nell talks in our book club, I'm like, wow, Nell is so bright. But it's like this thought process that you have. I mean, do you feel misunderstood, Nell?
Yeah, all the time.
When did that start?
Oh, God, what a deep question. I mean, I think I'm a recovering codependent. Shout out to all the recovering codependents. And I think for a long time as a codependent teenager, child growing up, you don't have a very strong sense of identity because you're just constantly trying to like become the perfect mirror to whoever you're around. And I think that it firstly just took a really long time for me to sort of figure out what that core identity of who Nell is, who I am, was. And even just own the fact that I'm intelligent. Combine that with the confusion of trying to hide your own intelligence to sort of fit in and be likable, especially if you're codependent and you're like, oh, I want you to like me so much. Okay, don't worry, I'm stupid. I think it was that toxic kind of, yeah, combination for me that like led to years of like tap dancing, I've heard people call it, of like just trying to be the right thing to fit in. And often being a smart woman wasn't correct.
Yeah, but it's also this thing that we're talking about with the G-string. Sorry to go back to the G-string, but it's like somehow or other you can't be like, you know, a siren. And actually, I had a really great chat with Dita Von Teese on this podcast in season 4, where she said that she felt that a woman saying, I want to be objectified and I want to wear something that would be perceived as racy and enjoy being objectified, say, I want that, is the last hurdle of feminism. Mm. And I think there's a lot to unpick there. It's a really complicated subject. But I think that she's onto something. I think that one of the issues is how we experience it from a really young age. And just, you know, as you've just mentioned, it has impacted your entire life, this trying to fit in and trying to be, I would say, something that you're not. But I do wonder if these things start from a very kind of early school age.
So I went to a Catholic school and it was a uniform wearing school, but every now and again we'd have a non-uniform day. And one non-uniform day when I was, I think, 13, I got sent home because apparently what I was wearing was too provocative, aged 13. And I got home and my mum works from home because she's a writer. And she was like, what are you doing here? And I said, I've been sent home because my top was too revealing. And she was like, take it off. And she took my top and she walked into my school and she walked into my deputy headmaster's office and held it up and screamed at him, this is a grey fucking t-shirt. And I was 13. I didn't know I had boobs, but basically my male Catholic teachers at my Catholic school felt uncomfortable seeing a 13-year-old girl who was like just starting to sprout breasts that she wasn't even bloody aware of yet in a slightly low-cut top. Like it was a grey t-shirt. I was wearing a grey t-shirt and jeans. It was like round neck. But yeah, apparently that made people feel uncomfortable. And that was my first very like obvious experience of me being the problem. You go home. You are the problem. You need to leave. As opposed to, oh, hang on. Maybe there's something wrong with me if I'm looking at a 13-year-old child and feeling uncomfortable. Mm.
But you know, the conversation around codependency and then trying to fit in. So if I had experiences like that at school too. Mm. And this podcast is not about me, so I'm not going to, but I just would say I really identify. And I would say that some of those early year experiences for me as a young woman are some of the things that started to really distort my own experience of myself within society. So I started to be conditioned without even knowing I was being conditioned by this judgment that was being put on me, yes, by systems that were put in place supposedly to protect us, but actually, as you've just said, actually highlight the fact that there's a problem potentially somewhere else. Mm. Do you think that that experience that you had that kind of knock-on effect into your life?
Definitely. I to this day have to unpick how I feel about my own sexuality. It confuses me so much because sexuality was projected onto me at such a young age, yeah, that I was sexy, that I'm like, and then that I definitely internalized it to begin with. And I was like, yeah, I am sexy. And that was like a badge that I wore with pride. And then, you know, the older I get and the less I enjoy I think there was a little bit of me that I'll admit to as a late teenager, in my early 20s, that really enjoyed like being looked at on the street and feeling like, oh yeah, I'm getting looked at. I'm getting looks on the street. Maybe it's the actor in me, I don't know. But it gave me some kind of affirmation that now I'm like, who cares? Like, and now I hate it. If someone looks at me on the street or whistles at me, I will shout at them. And I really loathe it. And it's for me like unpicking like, okay, so what is my sexuality? How do I feel about myself as a sexy woman, quote unquote? So it did, yeah, it really confused me, because later with like being called a slut a lot, that was like, I guess I am a slut, because ever since I was 13, people have said I'm like sexual in some way. So yeah, I'll take that label and kind of swallow it and internalize it and feel the shame that was intended behind that. Mm.
I just feel so sad. I'm sat here listening to you, and I just feel so sad for us all as human beings that somehow or other we've created this society where we're all so scared of each other and so threatened by sex that we even have these tropes of like being defined. I'm going to define that person over there as this thing so I can feel safe. Essentially, that's what it is.
Fear. I think it is fear-based. I think you're right.
Absolutely fear-based. Mm. But obviously you did then choose to go into the entertainment industry.
And
because you're very talented and good. And then that kind of experience that you had at school kind of carried on in the press when you were on the red carpet and the media started to discuss you. And what I find really interesting, so you had one specific experience.
Yeah.
Can you just say a bit about that?
Yeah, so after the first series of Victoria, in which I played a maid in a very Victorian grey dress with like a low bun and no makeup, looking really drab and plain, I wanted to look really glamorous for the premiere of the first season, and I wore a very glamorous dress and I looked very hot. And the Daily Mail ran an article online where the headline was, Nell Hudson reveals major side boob
major
at
side
Victoria
boob.
Premiere. And the content of the article was, you know, very laced with implicit misogyny, implicit Madonna whore complex crap, written by a woman, I will add. And yeah, it was just very clear that like there was judgment being made about it.
When you say Madonna whore complex, what do you mean by that?
Well, literally, obviously Madonna whore complex is women have to fit into those two camps. You're either a Madonna and you're a mother figure, or you're a whore and you're a sexual object. And in the article, they compared me to the leading actress in the show, Jenna. No shade to Jenna. And she wore a dress that was like quite high-necked and covered her up, and she looked absolutely stunning, but so did I. And it said like, meanwhile, Jenna Coleman looked elegant and graceful. And it was those sorts of epithets that were like, this is ladylike, this is appropriate. And then it's like, Nell Hudson's dress. And there was a poll at the end of the article, there was a poll that the public could take, which was, what did you think? And it was like, option A, this dress is completely unsuitable. Option B, maybe it would be better for a nightclub. And option C, I think she looks good. And I think, luckily, the public were woke enough to vote for option C.
That's not woke, that's just normal.
Well, just common sense.
I mean, maybe woke is normal, but that's not woke. That's being a healthy human being. One of the things that I found really, I mean, for me, when I met Nell and I have been friends for a few years, and when I first met her, one of the things that I said to her was that I thought she was extremely talented, and I think that actresses that can play the whole range of characters, from the sort of slightly more frumpy maid downstairs through to the royal glamour person, I said, you'll have a really long career, because I think what happens to us as actresses is we get pigeonholed. So you go, that's what you do. So I was quite excited for you that you had that range. But I completely understand that being spoken about like that in the media is unacceptable. One of the things that I was quite curious about with that dress was the Liz Hurley dress. Liz Hurley dress that went viral, where it was done up with safety pins down the side. And I did look up some of the articles around that time, and it's really weird now, but the language was different. It was lad culture. It was in a period of time when there was a lad culture about women. So that dress was worn in a period of time when the media was kind of like being laddie about women as well.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting that they were kind of they were uplifting that dress, which also showed, what was it? A huge amount of side boob. What did they?
Major.
Major amount of side boob. So Liz Hurley had a major amount of side boob as well. But they weren't degrading her in the same way as they were you.
Well, it was covert degrading. I think that's almost the problem. In a way, lad culture misogyny was, at least it was bloody out there and obvious, like, way... Look at these tits. Whereas with the Daily Mail article about me, it was just all these subtle little ways where they sort of know they can't get away with saying it anymore. So they say it in this kind of cloak and dagger way.
Mm. And was that your first experience in the media of being spoken about like that?
Yes.
And how, I mean, obviously you've just kind of expressed energetically how it made you feel, but what when you saw that article, what was your first response to it, both feeling and thinking?
I remember being filled with adrenaline because it was new to me, being like the Daily Mail column of shame. It was almost like a bit of an exciting thing at that time. I was kind of like, oh my God, I'm in the Daily Mail. How cool. I'm famous. Like, it's so silly. But like, that was the initial thing. It felt kind of exciting on one level. And then I didn't look at it genuinely for what must have been at least 5 years. I didn't think about it. And I blocked a lot of it. And then I'm actually writing a nonfiction book myself with a feminist agenda. And one of the chapters is on objectification. And I thought, well, I'd better bloody dig out that article then and talk about my own experience. And I'd completely blocked the thing about them comparing me to Jenna, because in my head, it was just like, Nell Hudson reveals major side boob. That was the headline. And then looking back at it and seeing how they'd done this, like, let's compare these two women thing and pit them against each other and talk and literally hold up examples, images of like what's okay as a woman and what's not. It made me really upset when I came back to it. I felt really hurt and sad. And I looked up the journalist because I was like, shall I write to her? Shall I confront this face to face? And I haven't. But maybe if the book comes out, I will.
Do you need me to beat her up for you?
No, I think we'd better not.
I'm available. Back to objectification now. Because I think there's something in what Dita Von Teese is saying. And I feel it's such a complex area at the moment. You're saying that you don't enjoy being whistled at on the street anymore. Mm. I'm in my late 40s. Men are stopping whistling at me. I'm like, why aren't they whistling at me anymore? I think that one of the things that we need to look at here is what's underneath it. And I think that our attitudes towards sex, because really what we're doing is we're shaming people for... presenting an idea of sex, and underneath that, as I've just said, is shame. Surely it's shame that we need to look at rather than objectification. Surely as human beings we're allowed to have a different feeling or experience about being objectified every day. One day, I mean, it's like, to me, somehow or other, we're coming at it from the wrong angle. Surely it's the shame that we feel as human beings is where we need to be really looking.
I mean, it's really interesting. I think, yes, there is a collective cultural shame around sexuality that needs very, very violently addressing. But then also, like, the onus is on men who whistle and men who leer and shout and, you know, harass women. And is that a shame thing? Is a man whistling because he feels collective cultural sexual shame, or is he whistling because he sees you as an object?
No, but I think the thing is, the tricky thing is where does the line lie between harassment and actually enjoying another human being? I don't have the answer. I just feel what Dita Von Teese said was really, really interesting about why we find being the human being, because it's so like, it's so steeped in kind of really historical shame that we have to somehow be humble and not enjoy being looked at. Like, we impose on our little people this thing that they have to be, like, you know, seen and not heard and small, and like, why aren't we allowed?
And don't be attention seeking.
That. It's exactly that. And I do think it's really complicated. Yeah. But I just think that it's worth always bearing in mind what we're, it's not, I don't think it's as black and white as objectification and not objectification, you know. And it gets even more complicated when you talk about whether what's going on with the young women now, as in like the 8 and 9 year olds who are seeing their famous pop stars who they love, and they're dressing like, you know, a teenager at 8 and 9, and then those young girls. So
I just did that at 8 and 9.
Yeah,
I saw the Moulin Rouge video with Christina Aguilera and Pink.
Yeah.
And I asked my mum for, like, suspenders and garter and stuff when I was, like, 8. Because I was like, that's so cool.
I know, but I just don't know what the answer is. Because is that bold? Or is that acting out?
Having, like, lived it, I think the answer is just to be like, you can dress up in those at home, but you can't wear them out. I think it's really important to not shame children for, like, wanting to emulate the people that they admire and say, like, you're naughty, you shouldn't, you know, no, you don't dress in things like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think that's more damaging, which is what you're saying, which is, like, shame. We've got to get rid of the shame.
Yeah. It does have a really bad impact on children's mental health. This conversation, as we've said, when you were at school, both of us have had bad experiences at school. Mm. What have you done in order to help your own mental health in this area that's impacted you so significantly?
So, it's so funny. Like, it shouldn't be up to me, but I've taken to really, like, covering up sometimes. If I'm just like, I cannot be bothered, because I have a dog, and often when I take my dog out, I get sexually harassed on the street, like, on a daily, weekly basis. People will say something to me that is unsolicited, and they wouldn't say if I was a man walking a dog. And so, purely for my own sanity, I'll just be like, I'm just going to put on a really big, oversized, shapeless coat, and even possibly, like, a hat to hide my hair and my blonde hair and all this stuff. That is just a, like, small self-protection measure that I sometimes take. I've actually had a t-shirt made. This is so geeky. I've had a t-shirt made that says, would you say it to a man? Because I am so sick of people saying things to me when I'm walking my dog that they would not say to a man. But also, I think humour is a really good antidote to...
Totally need to sell those on the Happy Vagina.
I don't have a business plan for those t-shirts. But yeah, I think laughing is a good way of dealing with it. I follow a lot of, like, really funny accounts on social media that completely subvert the narrative. And, like, Man Who Has It All on Twitter is a really good one.
Interesting. And in terms of your mental health, like, what do you do? So those are kind of, like, social things that you do.
Yeah.
What do you do about your mental health? So if there are any young women particularly that are listening to this podcast today who are identifying and struggling with trying to keep their mental... Well, actually, I suppose really what we're saying is keep their own self-esteem separate to what people say or think of them so that they don't go into shame spirals. Mm. What have been the things that help you to do that?
I think it's a lot about having a relationship with my body that is free of shame. And in all different ways, I feel that I've grown up in a world that wants me to be ashamed of my body, whether it's its size, its femininity, its sexuality, its paleness, all different things. Fully aware of my white privilege, and I'm just saying paleness in terms of, like, you know, we're sort of told that if you're too pale, you look this, you know, all sorts of things. But anyway, I think sort of eradicating shame from just my feelings about my own body means that if someone else tries to shame me, I know that I have a rock solid, like, internal boundary of, like, no, like, I don't feel ashamed about my body. So no matter what you throw at me, I feel good, because obviously you're going to be wobblier if you already feel kind of shit about yourself. If someone tries to make you feel bad about your body and you already do. So for me, working on that relationship with my body and my own self-esteem through yoga has really helped. Yoga gets you into your body like nothing else, for me, like no other form of exercise does. And sort of inhabiting the body properly and sort of seeing it as this incredible thing and gift as opposed to something to be looked at.
Yeah, and like something that actually just works for us to move us around and, like, look after
us.
Yeah,
and how lucky
I did see on your Instagram feed that you'd written a kind of list of, not affirmations.
Yeah, but affirmations.
Do you use that as a?
When I remember to.
Yeah.
I get really bad. My therapist told me years ago, like, write affirmations and gratitudes every single day. And I did it every day for a while and I've got a bit slack, but it does help. It definitely helps.
And you've mentioned therapy a few times. So is that something that's really helped you?
100%. I don't think I'd be here. Not joking. Wouldn't be here without it. Genuinely. It's really, really helped me. And I'm so lucky that I was able to have it. I know, having recently tried to go through basically my parents intervened. I had a really bad time with my mental health in my early 20s. And my parents just swooped in and were like, we're going to help you. I recently consulted the NHS for something about my mental health and have experienced now, like, quite how backlogged they are and overrun they are. And yeah, I feel incredibly lucky to have had the therapy that I've had, because it's really tough out there.
If you are listening to this podcast, we will actually genuinely put a list of resources for anyone who's struggling of affordable therapeutic help. I was joking about the seals. I'm serious about this. There will be a list of ways that you can go and get help, and some accounts that you can follow to support you if you're struggling with your body identity, or just, you know, generally feeling like you're losing yourself and you need some help to find yourself. Now, it's been such an honor speaking to you. Thank you so much for sharing. So honestly, it's been a really insightful, and some of the things that you've said and shared have been really brave. We can't finish this podcast without our genuinely favorite question, which we ask at the end of every podcast, and that is, now Hudson, what makes your vagina happy?
Lack of shame is a big one. We've been talking about shame a lot. I think having no shame around it, and like little things, like I used to be so embarrassed if I ever got like thrush, which happens. It's really normal to sometimes get thrush. I'd be like, oh God, I've got thrush. I can't tell my boyfriend, how embarrassing, or like mention it. Just like little things like that just help you just to be like, just normalize it, demystify it, connect with it, get to know it. Just like, yeah, just being a lot more familiar with it and a lot less embarrassed about it.
Big whoops and claps from the audience. I think that's a really, really beautiful answer, and that is a excellent place to end.
Let's end on thrush. Okay.
Now, Hudson, thank you so much for joining me at Jupiter Rising Festival in Scotland for this epic live recording of the Happy Vagina podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Jupiter Rising. Love you.
If you enjoyed this episode, please do follow, subscribe, and review. It helps others to find our podcast. And look out for our weekly videos going up on YouTube and Instagram at The Happy Vagina. Don't forget to check out our sponsors for this episode, the exquisitely simple, beautifully designed Beija London for all your lingerie and swimwear needs. www.beija.london. Once you've chosen your bra, pull some knickers to match, then use the code THEHAPPYVAGINA at checkout to receive 15% off your first order. That's www.beija.london.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.